Hello, everyone. Shabbat Shalom. This is a commentary on Parshat Beshalach, Exodus 13:17 through 18:1, and this is in response to last week's horrible events in Tucson. And I have to admit right now, this has been a very difficult piece to write, and it's still really a work in progress. I haven't figured this out myself yet, so I would welcome any comments, suggestions, questions, challenges. The best way to do that is to go to my blog site, www.mindfultorah.blogspot.com, and you can leave a comment there. So, as I said, when I sat down to write this week's commentary, I knew I wanted to connect it in some way with the tragic events this past Saturday in Tucson. However, how to do this while still being true to the basic concept of this blog was somewhat perplexing to me. And so, in good mindfulness fashion, I read through the text and sat to see what thoughts or ideas arose in my mind. After all, the parsha begins with the Israelites leaving, continues with the splitting of the Sea of Reeds and the drowning of Pharaoh's army, and ultimately also deals with the people complaining to Moses in the desert about water and food, leading to the first fall of manna from heaven and God directing Moses to strike the rock in order to get water. Oh, so much material. However, some verses jumped out at me as I reread the text. I've decided that I will simply state those verses first, and then see what happens. That way I don't have to keep going back citing chapter and verse as I write, or in this case, read the commentary. First verse. We read that God did not lead the people out by the way of the Philistines, for, quote, the people may have a change of heart when they see war and return to Egypt, unquote. Chapter 13, verse 17. And yet, we also read in verse 18, quote, the Israelites went up from Egypt armed, unquote. Next, God continues to stiffen Pharaoh's heart even after the Israelites leave, so he then pursues them. God does this so, quote, the Egyptians shall know that I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, God. That's chapter 14, verse 4. Next verse. When the Israelites see the Egyptians coming at the shore of the sea, they cry out, was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us to die in the wilderness? Chapter 14, verse 11. And question if it would have been, quote, better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness, unquote. That's verse 12. Next, when the Egyptians enter the sea, we read that God, quote, threw the Egyptian army into panic, quote, and then again, locked the wheels of their chariots. That's chapters 14, verses 24 and 25. As the sea closed in on them, the Egyptian army tried to flee, but, quote, God hurled the Egyptians into the sea. Not one of them remained. Chapter 14, verse 28. And then, when the people saw what God did at the sea, quote, the people feared Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. They had faith in God and in God's servant, unquote. In reviewing these verses, the characters of God, Pharaoh, and the Israelites called to me. I was surprised that Moses did not draw my attention, but perhaps I just see him as an extension of God in this moment. In the text, God knows instinctively that the people are not ready for conflict. They have been enslaved all these years, and so they would probably flee at the slightest sign of conflict. And yet, why do they leave Egypt armed for battle? Perhaps this serves as a reminder that even when we don't want or are afraid of conflict, we must still prepare for the unknown. Then, even though God knows the people will be afraid of war, he sends the fully loaded Egyptian army after them. But God does this for no other reason than to show the Egyptians who is really in charge. The whole encounter at the Sea of Reeds is meant to showcase God's power for the enemy. And yet, no Egyptians are present at the sea other than the soldiers that are killed. Except, perhaps, Pharaoh. For we are told that his soldiers, horses, and chariots entered the sea, but it does not say that Pharaoh himself did. Why? Well, perhaps his role was to witness the destruction and then be forced to take the news back to his people. When the Israelites see the army approaching, they do not take up the arms with which they have left Egypt. No, they react as we imagine a group of slaves might. They fear for their lives. Further, they criticize Moses for bringing them into the desert to die. And then, as the people berate Moses, and by extension, God, it is time for God to spring into action. The pillar of smoke that was leading the people, in which God was present, moves from the front to the rear, blocking the Egyptians from passing. Then Moses is instructed to stretch out his staff and split the sea. The miracle has begun. Wasn't this enough? Why did God need more? If God split the sea, let the Israelites through, and then closed it, leaving the Egyptians on the other side, wouldn't the power of God be undeniable? But this was not enough for the God of Exodus. This God needs to leave no question as to the extent of divine power. So God allows the Egyptians to enter the sea. Then God confounds them. God makes their wheels stick so the chariots cannot move. And finally, as they try to escape the walls of water closing in on them, God literally hurls them back into the sea. It is only then that the people fear God and have faith in God and Moses. Of course, not long thereafter, they lose their faith repeatedly as they continue to complain to Moses and question his leadership and God's power. But I'm not going to go into that part of the parsha. Rather, I want us to look at one specific moment. If mindfulness is about being aware of each moment and our connection to God in that moment, which is how I would define it, then the moment I would like us to experience is when the Egyptians have been killed in the sea, and as we read in verse chapter 14, verse 27, quote, "the sea returned to its normal state," unquote. And so it seemed. In that moment, the sea looked the same as it had before it had split, and before it had covered the Egyptians. And yet the sea is not the same. For beneath its surface lie the victims of God's need to show what divine power was all about. Beneath the waves is the collateral damage of God's campaign of shock and awe. One can only imagine that part of the fear of the Israelites were feeling in the moment was the fear that what just happened to the Egyptians could just as easily happen to them. Who knows? They don't trust God yet. They don't know God yet. All they know is what they are feeling in the moment. And not long before this, they questioned whether Moses and God should have let them stay in Egypt as servants. If they react like that again, what would stop God from killing them? And so, the only way they could move on is by imagining that the sea was just the same as it was before, and by singing a song of joy for their redemption. But they have not yet begun to sing. As is human inclination, I am already thinking of the future, rather than being in the present. For this is the moment that will give birth to singing. They are not ready to sing just yet. They are still in shock and disbelief. And what about on the other side of the sea? If this act of divine violence and redemption was meant to prove God's might to the Egyptians, how will they find out? Certainly when their husbands, sons, and brothers don't return home, they will know something has happened. But what would they believe? That a group of ex-slaves somehow defeated the Egyptian army? Perhaps. We don't know. I imagine at this moment Pharaoh is standing on the other side of the sea asking himself these same questions. Not only that, but he is questioning why he is there. His mind jumping to the immediate past, he wonders why he followed the Israelites when he had just freed them. Now that it's all over, he realizes that he would not have done what he did if some other force were not urging him on. And so he stands there, grief-stricken at the loss, confused as to why it had to happen, and frightened of what he is going to tell his people when he returns. And he stands there both in awe of and furious at this God of the Israelites, for he knows in his heart that this God was the force behind everything. But how does all this relate to our present moment? After a week in which we mourned such great loss as a nation, where are we? I believe we are in both the place of Pharaoh and the place of the Israelites. We are split, We are standing on both sides with the sea seemingly serene, yet actually a watery grave in between. We are examining ourselves as a nation. We wonder what led up to last week's horrific event. We are casting blame. We are in shock. As a nation, we may be armed with weapons of self-defense and mass destruction, like the Israelites, and yet we know that at any moment something unexpected could happen, and none of that will matter. As witnesses to death, we are mindful of our own mortality, and we are afraid of the possibilities. And yet there is something in us that is urging us to open our mouths in song of praise in spite of all this, but we are not quite ready to do that. For we are also Pharaoh. We are filled with confusion at what has happened to our country and its people. We are furious at whatever force is behind this violence. Even if a primary motivating factor was mental illness, which is beyond our control and must seriously be addressed by our nation, there was some other force that brought us to this place, where we are standing at the sea, which is burying our dead. And where is God in all this? In the narrative, God is the prime mover. God is the force behind all that happens. But how can we say that God is the force behind the violence in our country? I can't. But I can say that there are forces beyond our control and understanding that are part of the cosmic scheme of things. For evil and violence are also a part, a natural part, of God's created world, whether or not we like to realize that. But God is also the force that is helping us at this moment to come to terms with where we are. As Pharaoh, God is the force telling us that we must let go of our need to show power. We must let go of our need to be right. For if we do not, it will eventually destroy us, those we love, our country, and our world. We don't like to admit when our actions cause bad things to happen, or that we have allowed other forces to compel us to act in ways we know are wrong. But that is simply one of the truths of reality. And the only way to stop this from happening again is to be aware of that reality in each moment. As the Israelites, God is also the force that is helping us to realize that there are things beyond our control, and that there is evil and violence in the world. And yet we must continue. We must prepare ourselves to sing, to celebrate. And we can only do so by pretending that the world is the same as it was before, while also knowing within us that this is anything but the truth. When President Obama spoke to the nation the other day, he called upon us to move beyond blame and partisan bickering. He called on us to find the best within ourselves in order to make our country and our world the best it can be. In short, he called on us to take the next step, even knowing that the dead are still right before us. And so here we are. We know, as Pharaoh did, that we must let go of our need for power, that we must humble ourselves and even take on some of the blame as a society. But we must also continue on, as we must assume he did when he returned to his people. And we know, as did the Israelites, that this is both a frightening and a beautiful world, that with each step we can act from a place of fear or faith, doubt or trust. And we know what we must do in this moment. While acknowledging all of these complexities and contradictions that exist within and around us, we must turn away from the sea, take the next step on our journey, and sing with joy for life, for love, and for all the world.